For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Devastation in the heart of Port Vila.
God knows what it was. There's multiple buildings that have come down.
This CCTV from inside a car repair shop showing the violence of the magnitude 7.3 quake.
We look back 1 year ago when a 7.3 earthquake struck Vanuatu. How is the island nation doing? After 80 years, the missing wreckage of a World War II bomber has finally been found.
We're very grateful to Willie Flynn, a young 15-year-old PNG guy who trekked into the site over several days and located the wreck. My family is both saddened but delighted to at least know the outcome of Tom's, his final resting place.
And the first ever OFC Pro League competition will kick off in the Pacific in 2026.
We'll witness in reality the official unveiling of the first ever professional club of men's football, together with 17 Nivanuatu players.
Stories and more shortly. But before we start, we'd like to give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, also known as Melbourne. Well, bon dia, iorana, maloni and good fellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Egi Tupo, and I say malo apito. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, it was on this day, 1 year ago, that Vanuatu's capital, Port Vila, was rocked by a massive 7.3 magnitude earthquake. Let's take a listen to a report from that day.
Devastation in the heart of Port Vila.
Just had a major earthquake in Port Vila. God knows what it was. There's multiple buildings that have come down.
Across the city, buildings were flattened and cars crushed while people fled for safety as the ground shook. This CCTV from inside a car repair shop showing the violence of the magnitude 7.3 quake.
I was standing by my truck and it felt like my truck was jumping.
In the chaos, the death toll remains unclear. So far, one person is confirmed dead, but locals fear that figure will rise.
And that death toll did rise to 14, with hundreds injured, and scores of buildings were destroyed in the earthquake. Now, 1 year on, life is returning to normal. Tourists are visiting again, but many demolished buildings are yet to be rebuilt, and some locals are frustrated at the pace of repairs. The ABC's Lily Rose Wellwell in Vanuatu filed this report on the earthquake's anniversary.
Where buildings once stood, there's now open space, caps in the centre of Port Vila. 1 year ago, a powerful earthquake struck the heart of Vanuatu's capital, collapsing buildings. While the rubble has been cleared, the memory still lives on. Yeshua Shing remembers the day clearly.
Standing here, well, one of my brothers died here. It's very sad to come and pass this place all the time to see and to remember that this place used to be one of the places we come every time to eat and just to come and chill. And now we don't have this anymore.
Cyril Menke is a structural engineer and vice president of the Vanuatu Engineers Association. He helped inspect damaged buildings after the earthquake.
You know, we lost 14 lives. Just one life, when you lose it, it's too much. 14 is definitely too much. So my appeal to the whole population of Vanuatu, and especially the authorities, because, you know, our government, they draft the laws, but they need to make sure they enforce it. And we must not have, we must not lose lives again when it comes to earthquake.
Port Vila's rebuilding is underway. The government has signed various construction, including an $85 million package with China. Also linked is a $24 million grant from the Asian Development Bank for redeveloping damaged roads. On the streets of Port Vila, life is returning to normal. Tourists like Australian Alison Louise Quattrell are back.
Came by boat, so on the cruise ship. I think it's really beautiful here. I love the beaches. It was really nice. We went to the Blue Lagoon area. It was very beautiful there. Yeah. Well, this is our first time coming here. We did hear about the earthquake.
Tourists are an important part of Vanuatu's economy. And the good news is government is forecasting at least one cruise ship visit per day for the next 4 months. It's welcome news. Ruth Fari, a market fender.
After the earthquake, our sales are recovering slowly.
She's upbeat as she sells soaps, creams and beauty products under a tent where a building once stood.
The rebuild of Vanuatu is getting there, but it is slow.
Joshua Sheng is a musician who performs in hotels and venues around the capital and is welcoming visitors back with open arms.
Past 6 months, tourists are coming back and the resorts are opening, hotels are opening again. And for us as musicians, I play and perform at the resorts and hotels and I'm back on my feet again, I can stand. But so far, so good. So happy to have tourists back in Port Vila City. And, yes, looking forward to seeing more tourists come back.
But recovery has not been even. Large parts of the city centre remain quieter than before, with many businesses still operating from temporary locations outside the city. Port Vila business owner Lopez Adams says progress feels slow.
Unfortunately, Port Vila CBD is not very lively. We need to bring back some life into the centre of the city. We need activities, we need entertainment, we need things that can anchor our tourists. So when they go back, they can tell their friends that, oh yeah, Port Vila is ready to receive you.
Mr. Adams runs a cafe and an employment incubator for young people. He says government can encourage growth by relaxing restrictions.
We're not asking for financial assistance from our government. We are asking our government to relax all the rules that makes it very difficult for business to operate, for business, new business to come in, for investors to come in.
Port Vila residents are today reflecting on the devastation of last year's earthquake, but they're also calling on the government to look to the future and plan the city's growth.
Well, for more on our coverage of Vanuatu's earthquake anniversary, we cross now to our reporter in Port Vila, Lily Rose Wellwell. Good morning, Lily Rose.
Good morning, Aki.
Thank you so much for joining us. As we've been speaking, today marks, 1 year since the earthquake, and I know it's a very emotional time for the people of your country. You know, no doubt lots of memories from last year's disaster. Lily Rose, how is the anniversary being marked today?
So today is being observed primarily as a memorial day, but it also carries a broader meaning. It's a day to remember those who lost their lives and at the same time to recognize the efforts of people who responded in the immediate aftermath, like medical teams, engineers, emergency services, and security forces. So the mood across Port Vila is subdued. Active, but it's also a strong sense of gratitude along with the grief.
Lily Rose, can you sort of take us through the government program for today, though?
The government has So the government has organized a full day of remembrance activities that combine official observance with community led events. The program includes a public procession through the city, a formal ceremony with prayers and speeches, family testimonies, exhibitions documenting the earthquake. It also provides space to acknowledge frontline responses before concluding later in the day with a faith-based service and candlelight commemorations.
And I understand the march will actually end up at the Billabong building. Lily Rose, what's the significance of this site?
Well, the Billabong building is the most significant site associated with the earthquake. It's where most of the lives were lost when the building collapsed. It's also a space, it's also a place where emergency responders, medical teams, engineers, and security forces had to work under extremely difficult conditions to recover survivors and recover victims, to rescue survivors and recover victims. So ending that march there recognizes both the human loss and the efforts of those who responded in the hours and days that followed.
Mm. And also, could you tell us about the monument, which I believe is going to be unveiled today, right?
Yeah, so the monument is basically in commemoration of those who have lost lives and in that building. So, you know, there's around 14 people that that lost their lives during the earthquake. So the monument is to be placed there in the commemoration of that of the lives that were lost, but also for the businesses and people who have lost their jobs just a damage to the Port Vila city when the earthquake happened last year.
Mm. Lily Rose, I'd love to sort of hear what it's like where you are right now. Could you describe what's happening? I mean, are there people already gathering for today's march?
People are slowly gathering, some with flowers and, you know, standing and talking slowly. The program will obviously begin at around 10 o'clock, but there will be a rally that will be starting from the Kape area up to the main CBD. So the atmosphere is calm, respectful, reflecting both the remembrance and appreciation of the day.
Mm. You earlier in the piece, you know, your radio story at the start of the show, I know you talked about space, right? Like the gaps in the city centre. I'm wondering, are there other reminders of the earthquake's damage, though?
There are clearly reminders. There's a lot of reminders around town. Beyond the empty lots, there are buildings that never reopened, temporary fencing in parts of the city, and businesses that continue to operate from relocated sites. So there are also less reminders. People remain cautious, and especially multi-story buildings, even a year later.
Mm. And that's it. It's only been a year, Lily Rose, but if you were to take us back, what were you actually doing this time last year when the earthquake struck?
So I was actually in the Lolam building, where now it's an empty plot. It has been demolished, with a group of journalists attending a workshop because we were preparing for the election that same month.
That's right.
The following month. So we were on top of the floor preparing for the upcoming elections when the earthquake struck, and the building shook violently, and we evacuated after the earthquake ended. It's a moment that remains very clear. We saw a lot of things happening. Mm. There's someone who broke his leg and all that. So this, we were at the center of it all. I was at the center of it all when it happened.
Grateful that you're still here with us, Lily Rose. I mean, goodness, it's, you know, 1 year on, and I can only understand the trauma from last year, probably still in your mind and in the minds of many people, right?
Yes, even people who are in the offices when the earthquake happened, they had to run outside. There were some ladies that we spoke to who said they had to relocate because the customers are scared to come upstairs to go to buy their goods. So life has continued, but the trauma hasn't disappeared. For families who lost their loved ones, and for those who were involved in the rescue and recovery efforts, the memory still lives on. So there's resilience and rebuilding, but there's also a lasting awareness of vulnerability, and that's why today it's both a day of remembrance and a day of thanks.
Absolutely. And look, all the best for you and all of those in Port Vila this morning, gathering 1 year after that earthquake. So, Lily Rose, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Aki.
That is ABC reporter in Vanuatu, Lily Rose Wellwell. And yes, we just heard from her, but now we cross to Vanuatu-based journalist Dan McGarry, who was there on that fateful day. With that, though, I say welcome, Dan, to Pacific Beat.
Good morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Dan, firstly, take us back, you know, a year ago. Where were you and what was happening around you?
Well, I was working at home with my daughters, and, you know, every time there's an earthquake, and there are frequent earthquakes here in Vanuatu, we all have this moment where we pause and, you know, try to get the measure of it. But the moment this one hit, we all knew that this was unprecedented, you know, that this was something that we'd never experienced before. And so I yelled to the girls to get out, and as we were making our way down the hall, the main shock hit and literally just threw us against the wall. So one of them was hanging off my shirt as we sort of maneuvered our way outside.
Wow.
I think at that moment, we didn't really have a sense of just how bad it had been. The weird thing about earthquakes is that they are over, you know, they seem to last an eternity, but they're over in seconds. And, you know, you live with the impact of it for, you know, a very long time afterwards.
And was there any sort of immediate damage, though, to where you were at home?
Well, I'm lucky enough to live in a very, very well-built house. So we had a lot of things sort of thrown about. Our TV got thrown on the floor and was totaled. And there were a few things like this. But the damage in our home relative to what happened in the center of town is, you know, it's not really comparable. So we were very, very fortunate.
Thank goodness. Yes. And Dan, look, we know that Port Vila was directly affected by the 7.3 earthquake. I mean, how much do you remember of it, you know, that whole day, and what does it even look like now, a year on?
Yeah, it is a fairly vivid memory, as you can imagine. These things do tend to stamp themselves on your brain. And just in preparation for this conversation, I was going back through some of my old tweets and the news that was coming out at that moment. I think within an hour or so, we had a sense that this was, you know, an historical event, in the sense that, you know, the scope of the impact on the town. We knew that buildings were destroyed. We knew that the wharf road was severely damaged. And we knew that there had been fatalities. I went down to Vila Central Hospital. That's our main hospital. About 25 minutes after the quake struck, and it was really remarkable to watch how quickly the recovery efforts swung into play. There was already a triage center set up outside the hospital. Casualties were arriving, you know, even as we spoke. I saw three seriously injured people waiting treatment. But what impressed me, and what always impresses me in response to disasters here in Vanuatu, is just how everybody pulled together. There was no panic. There was no screaming, no yelling, no running around. People were focused on helping those who needed help. And that really is the one indelible memory that will stay with me for as long as I live. It's really remarkable, you know. People, if you watch disaster movies, you know, the moment things start to break down, that's when, you know, society breaks. But that's not what happens here in Vanuatu. It is remarkable at how tightly knit society becomes, you know, as tightly knit as we were before. We're even more tightly bound together in times of adversity. And this has been a level of adversity that we haven't seen in many, many years.
Yeah, which is really encouraging to hear, Dan. And, you know, one of the many visuals we saw was that of that Billabong store, you know, completely pancaked. And you talk about recovery efforts sort of just coming in straight away. I mean, but how has it been so far in the, the reconstruction of Port Vila, and how the community is feeling since then?
You know, some of the unsung heroes of the recovery effort are a small group of public servants who set up an operations center in tents in front of the Prime Minister's office. And for weeks, they were trying to manage the risk and trying to speed the recovery through this whole, through the center of town. Now, you have to bear in mind that all of our banks, all of our major infrastructure, our power generation, a very, very significant amount of our key infrastructure, communications as well, were all running right through that part of town that was most affected. And, you know, this is our hot season. It was, you know, 34, 35 every day, almost 40 under the tents. And these people were working dawn to dusk, you know, round the clock to try and get everything done. It was a really commendable effort. It's taken a great deal of time for things to even just get cleaned up. And now, as I'm sure Lily Rose told you already, you know, the center of town looks like a fighter with some teeth knocked out, you know, like there are gaps there. And all of us who have lived in Port Vila for, you know, for decades, we see the gaps, you know, like we see what's missing. And I think that still continues to exact an emotional toll.
Dan, the whole thing about, you know, trade and tourism, right? That would have been affected greatly after the earthquake. But I understand that ADB, our Australian Development Bank, they've actually approved a $24.4 million grant to sort of rehabilitate Port Vila's Wharf Road. I mean, it sounds like a lot of money. Is that enough to sort of see, you know, even with the ongoing issues that are happening there in Port Vila?
Quite frankly, that sounds like the right amount for, you know, it's a substantial amount for a country as small as ours. But the damage to the road was substantial, and safeguarding that critical part of our national infrastructure, you know, against further damage by cyclones or earthquakes or what have you, is a non-trivial task, as the engineers sometimes say. The scope of the damage there, that was the very first thing that I was able to report on. I managed to get a drone up from my house and to fly it over the Wharf Road. There just an entire hillside came down there. There were pieces of, you know, there were stones as big as a house that had rolled down onto the, you know, into the wharf area. The fact that we've managed to keep it working at all is remarkable. And it doesn't surprise me, frankly, that it's taken a year for us to even begin to you know, get going on that part of the recovery effort. This is, you know, 20 seconds that's going to live with us for a very long time still.
And I have to talk about that, Dan, because, you know, most importantly, we understand the trauma, the impacts it's had on the young and the old there in Vanuatu when a traumatic event like this happens. So really, frankly, how are you doing and how has the family been since then?
Well, you know, as I say, people in Vanuatu are accustomed to disaster. That doesn't mean it's easy on us. It just means that we're used to it. And so, you know, people know what to do. They respond in a very healthy and supportive way. The fact is that now, whenever we feel even a minor earthquake, people react, you know, very, very differently than they did before. There's that apprehension that never really went away, you know, that this could happen to us again. There is an awareness as we, you know, go about our business that something has changed quite fundamentally in, you know, that the Port Vila is never going to be the Port Vila that we knew. And that exacts a real toll. And then, of course, on top of that, in a tightly knit community like ours, losing 14 people and having hundreds injured is a massive toll when you compare that to the size of our population. There is nobody who was not personally affected by, you know, damage or human tragedy. And it's on days like this when we commemorate the loss that I think people understand just how important it is, you know, to care for our loved ones and to support them, you know, through thick and thin.
And yeah, talking about that, Dan, of course, today is somewhat a memorial day. As Lily Rose reported, people are going to be there in the city centre. Are you going to be joining the anniversary today, or how are you going to be remembering what happened there in Port Vila?
I have the unfortunate task of I've got a work day, so I won't be able to get away until this evening. There will be a candlelight ceremony later, and I'm pretty sure that we'll all be there for it. Our family is planning on attending. In fact, my wife gave me a long look when I told her I wouldn't be able to make it this morning. So, you know, people are taking it quite seriously. It is, as I say, a major moment in the lifetimes of people who, frankly, have seen disaster before. You know, in the last 10 years or so, we've been through three major cyclones in the capital alone, and in the islands there were more. There were a couple of others, you know, that were category 4 or 5. So this is one in a long series of disasters, but it is one that has changed the landscape in a really fundamental way.
Yeah. Well, look, Dan, our thoughts are with you and all those in Port Vila this morning as you guys remember what happened a year ago. But again, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
That is Vanuatu-based journalist Dan McGarry.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges. From how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
82 years after it vanished over Papua New Guinea, the wreckage of a missing Royal Australian Air Force World War II bomber has finally been found deep in the jungle. The discovery came after years of painstaking planning, and the original crash site was first pointed out by a teenager trekking through remote rainforest. For the families of the crew, young airmen who never returned from their mission on December 14th, 1943, it's a moment that's brought a mix of relief, sorrow and answers to long-held questions. The ABC's PNG correspondent Marion Farr spoke with Robert Burrows, the nephew of Tom Burrows, one of the air gunners on the missing plane.
Tom went on his first mission on the 14th of December 1943. The mission was to fly over and bomb Rabaul, which at that point was a well-held Japanese base. We're talking December 43 here, and by that stage Rabaul was the headquarters of the Japanese Pacific Campaign. And there were 10 planes in Squadron 100. Of the 10 planes that went to bomb Rabaul in appalling weather, only three made the target because of the weather. Two bombed alternate targets, four returned to base without even completing the mission. And tragically, one plane did not return to base and was listed as missing. It took 82 years, tragically and sadly for my father, who waited until last year at the age of 101, hoping to find out the fate of his brother for the wreck to be located. We're very grateful to Willie Flynn, a young 15-year-old PNG guy who actually trekked into the site over several days and located the wreck. He brought that news to his father, David Flynn, who's a long-time wreck searcher in PNG. So after 82 years, my family is both saddened but delighted, if you know what I mean, to at least know the outcome of Tom's, his final resting place.
How did you and your family feel when they received news of this discovery?
I got a phone call from Group Captain Grant Kelly, and he said, we'd just like to let you know that we've discovered the wreck of your uncle's plane. And to be honest, I didn't say much for a bit because, as you can imagine, I was quite emotional at the news. And I was a bit sad that Dad wasn't there to get that call himself, because I think it would have meant the world to him, and it obviously meant a great deal to me. And I think, you know, since then we've got more information, and what we've found is that it's, for example, we found out that the plane crashed. It was in a nosedive, basically, and it burnt on impact. So, you know, it's not fun to imagine what it would have been like in those last terrifying moments as the plane's in a nosedive and presumably completely out of control, and whether that was the weather, an engine failure, or possibly shot. But Presumably not. So I think it's been good news in the sense that it's good to know the outcome finally, even if it's about what we expected. But at the same time, there's a lot of sadness because we now finally know what happened to Dad's twin.
The plane was discovered a few years ago by Willie Flynn. Did you, your dad or your family have any inkling that it might be the plane that Tom was in?
Look, obviously my father and my brother and I speculated on that at some length, but it's pretty meaningless. Dad knew David Flynn quite well. Dad went to a commemorative service in Rabaul in 2012 to mark the what was then the 70th anniversary of the sinking of the Montevideo Maru, and he met David Flynn. At that point, young Willie would have only been about 2 years old, so he doesn't, you know, I don't know if Dad saw the little kid running around, but that's lost, of course, in time now. But he certainly knew David, and David had been a long-term hunter of these wrecks, and he was quite competent. So they'd got as far as being pretty certain it was a Beaufort. There were three Beauforts it could have been. Right? And Thomas was one of those three. So, you know, with one out of three odds, you figure it's a chance. But it's also the case that, as I said, after 80 years, you know, you sort of get a bit used to the idea it's not going to be the one, you know? And so I think we harboured the hope, but it was tempered by the reality that it might be one of the others. And that's why I think it was so stunning to me, even when I got the call from Joe Callahan saying, oh, we're just checking it, you're a relative of Tom Burrows on this, and, you know, how do you know him and what's the connection, and, you know, sort of establishing that I had a legitimate connection with him. And I think the point was, well, again, I'm just so used to the fact they've never found the damn plane. I just didn't expect it. And even when Grant Kelly rang it, he was halfway through the first sentence before I was like, bloody hell, they've found the plane.
And that there is Robert Burrows speaking there to PNG correspondent Marion Farr. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. This is the time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines for our news wrap. And the only person that can bring that to us is our producer, Kyle Evans, who's in the studio with me this morning. Good morning, Sue. How you doing?
I'm well, Aggie. It's definitely that time of year where things are feeling like they're starting to wind down a little bit, right. But the news does not stop, does it?
No, it doesn't. And yes, Christmas is around the corner. And I believe the weather even today in Melbourne, it's going to be a hot one.
A very hot one, yeah. 36 degrees, if I'm not mistaken. Ooh. So I've come prepared today. Yes. I almost wore a singlet to the office.
Nice. Okay, well, let's get into it. We actually head to Samoa because the opposition leader, Tuila Epasailele Marielenga Oi, he's actually been suspended over remarks made about the Prime Minister. What's happening here?
Yeah, so he was whacked with a 24-hour suspension during the final parliamentary sitting for 2025, essentially for getting up and accusing the Prime Minister of quote-unquote, talking crap about him. Wow. Now, he didn't actually use that word crap. It was the more profane version of that, if you catch my drift.
Wow.
The remarks were made during Tuesday's parliamentary break and stemmed from a ministerial address made by the PM, where he essentially blamed Tuliepa for all the criticism and slander directed at the new government in the media.
Wow.
That was too much for Tuliepa to stomach, who then confronted the PM afterwards in a way that the Speaker of the House deemed to breach parliamentary standards. Tuliepa disagreed with that, saying the remarks were conversational rather than, a formal parliamentary contribution. And he said they were made because he believed that the Prime Minister was accusing him of treason and staging a coup, and that he himself was actually denied the right to reply afterwards.
My goodness.
Yeah, pretty heated stuff, Aggie.
A little bit. Well, I'm wondering, can we expect to see the opposition leader back in Parliament?
Yes. So, according to reports, he's expected to rejoin today's parliamentary session after the first tea break. So that's when the suspension will be lifted. This is when the sin bin yes. Will be
back
lifted.
Back on the field after that. All right. We will wait and see how that goes. I want to switch to sport, though, because Vanuatu, they've actually been left out of the OFC hosting rights for next year. Why is that?
Yeah, great question, Aggie. So Vanuatu is not going to host any Oceania Football Confederation matches next year. So the Vanuatu Daily Post has reported that their facilities don't meet FIFA standards, and that means they therefore can't host any OFC tournaments. So apparently FIFA has strict requirements around things like spectator facilities, safety zones, and media amenities, change rooms, things like that, which they apparently don't have.
Wow. Is this the first time, though, this has happened?
Well, that's the thing about this. This is the first time I can recall it happening, but it wasn't that long ago. It was only in 2024 when OFC President Lambert Moltok was literally reduced to tears watching the Vanuatu men line up in the final of the OFC Men's Nations Cup at Freshwater Stadium in Vanuatu. Okay. So, I mean, their amenities were good enough then, so I'm not sure why they're not good enough now. It's quite strange, and I'm hoping to get some clarification on that on our program later in the week. But what's more interesting is that this lockout comes at a time when the OFC Pro League is literally about to kick off. You know,
yes,
the first professional
in January, right?
Exactly, the first professional soccer league in the Pacific. So, not only will Vanuatu not be able to host any OFC tournaments, they also won't host any rounds of the OFC Pro League, which features a Vanuatu team. You know, Vanuatu United FC, and you know, given this is a brand new club, you know, you really want to generate some momentum right off the bat. Yeah. And they're not going to have a chance to do that because they're not going to play any home games. So things like gate revenue and just building a fan base is potentially going to be hard to do.
A little unfortunate though, right? Because you're thinking, okay, they would have known for a while now that this is, you know, it's going to kick off in January, that it did not give them enough time maybe to try and set up the facility to be ready.
Yeah, well, in some ways, I guess that's kind of been the overarching narrative of the whole competition is that have they had enough time to prepare this thing properly? I certainly hope they do, but yes, in Vanuatu's case, they are a little bit behind the eight ball. But at the same time, it means so much, I think, to the country. We're literally going to have a story after this today from our reporter Richard Ewart, basically just, you know, bringing us the sights and the sounds of the official launch of that Vanuatu Pro League team. So you'll get an idea just how much it means to them, but they won't have home games to be able to go and cheer them on.
All right, we shall see. Okay, well, I want to switch to rugby league because the PNG Orchids head coach has stepped away.
Yeah, that's right. So Tani Norris and the PNG RFL have agreed to part ways, with the governing body announcing the news yesterday. So it means Norris won't lead the Orchids into the 2026 World Cup. The departure was mutual, according to reports, and PNG RFL Chairman Sander Sarkar has thanked her for all her efforts and contributions over the past few years, some of which included leading the team into the 2024 Pacific Cup against Australia and New Zealand and the 2025 Pacific Bowl against the Cook Islands and Tonga. Wow. So as of now, the governing body will now commence a thorough recruitment process to identify who the next head coach might be.
There you go, Kyle. Is that something you'd look for?
Well, I mean, geez, I do love my rugby league, Aggie. Yes. I don't know if I'm quite experienced on that front. But look, it'll be a great opportunity for whoever takes it on board. That's for sure. Because look, I mean, you know, given that PNG is obviously getting a men's NRL team, I can't imagine it'll be too far down the track before they try and implement a women's NRL team as well. So,
absolutely. Okay. We shall wait and see. Thank you very much, though, Kyle, for bringing our news rep here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
Celebrate this Christmas Eve with A Pacific Christmas. Featuring the uplifting voices of the Pacifica Victoria Choir. Enjoy a magical evening of traditional and island-inspired Christmas songs ready to light up your Christmas season. A Pacific Christmas, 5 p.m. PNG time, Christmas Eve, and also on Christmas Day at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Thabol. Well, it is a tough day for many in Vanuatu on the anniversary of the earthquake a year ago. But on a happier note, for the soccer-loving nation, fans have something big to look forward to, the OFC Pro League, which is just a month away now. The first ever professional competition in the Pacific kicks off on January 17th, and the opening match will feature Fiji's Bulla FC taking on Vanuatu United. For the 17 Vanuatu players, players in the squad, it will be a first taste of life as a pro alongside half a dozen foreign recruits. And as Richard Hewitt reports, the hard work is about to begin after the team nicknamed the Chiefs was given an official launch in Port Vila.
The arrival of the first ever Vanuatu United squad, and as the players took to the stage, a proud moment for the president of the OFC and the Vanuatu Football Federation, Lambert Maltok.
A moment that has, of course, been years of dreamings and years in the making. We'll witness in reality the official unveiling of the first ever professional club of men's football, together with 17 new Vanuatu players who turn into professionals tonight. Please welcome Anukita Loro. For many years, Vanuatu, as well as other nations in Oceania, have shared a common dream to see Pacific football stand tall on the global stage, not only through passion, but through a sustainable professional pathway that empowers our players, coaches and clubs. So the OFC Professional League is now the realization of such dream.
One of the overseas players who has opted to become part of football history in Vanuatu is goalkeeper Matt Acton. Once an under-20 Australian international with 50 A-League games behind him with Brisbane Roar and Melbourne Victory, he'll be the wise head at the heart of the Chiefs' defence.
Yeah, really honoured to be here in such a, you know, momentous occasion for everyone here in Vanuatu, and yeah, really feel privileged to be here and really proud to be standing here tonight.
17 January 2026, support OFC. First game, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, it's really exciting playing at Eden Park as well. It's such a massive stadium, and yeah, we're really looking forward to obviously getting the season underway, and we'll be working really hard between now and then to make sure that we're ready to put a competitive performance in. Players are excited. I'm sure the fans will be really excited when they watch it on TV, and for us players, we can't wait to get a really full life of Vanuatu.
Lars Hopp, a man with a long history as player and coach in Europe, will take charge of the Chiefs in their debut season. And doubling up as Vanuatu's national coach, he already has a trophy in the bag after his side toppled Papua New Guinea in the MSG Prime Minister's Cup final just last month.
And Bill Kaltek wins it for Vanuatu! Vanuatu celebrate their first ever MSG Prime Minister's Football Cup 2025 champions.
Well, first of all, hello to everyone. Thank you for coming tonight and great to see you all. Coming back from the tournament in PNG, it was good to have a little break in between, I think, and now I'm gathering all the boys today for the first time. It's just a great feeling because it's not always you get the chance to handpick every single player. So I can truly say that all the guys in the squad, they are my favorite players.
And I think with this group and also with the support we feel in the whole country, we will be well prepared and we're very optimistic.
So with just a month to go before the big kickoff, anticipation is rising and no one is more excited than Lambert Maltok and about what professional football could mean for his country.
This is actually the dawn of a new era, one that gives our best players the chance to stay in the region, develop their careers and inspire the next generation. The new competition platform will be the window of our professional players where we can promote them for international market. Vanuatu United FC is all about creating opportunity, not just for footballers, but for our entire communities who live and breathe this beautiful game.
In that report, ending with new music celebrating Vanuatu's brand new professional soccer team. And that was Richard Hewitt reporting on the Chiefs' official launch. And just to confirm, January 17th is the day when they'll take to the field for the very first time in what will be the opening fixture of the OFC Pro League against Buller FC. Well, there's been progress towards eliminating malaria in the Asia-Pacific region, according to the World Malaria Report. The report, which was published recently, draws from the World Health Organization data. While Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands still experience malaria, Dr. Satyek Das, CEO of Asia-Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance, says one close neighbour, Timor-Leste, became malaria-free this year.
The region saw a major reduction of over 725,000 malaria cases in 2024, and 11 of the 17 countries that are endemic from malaria reported declines. So to put that into a simple number, the estimated cases fell from 9.6 million to 8.9 million. And probably one of the most important things is that in July 2025, Timor-Leste, if you go back 20 years, they were a highly endemic country, malaria endemic country. They are now malaria-free certified.
What do we know about the Pacific region specifically?
In the Pacific, it's a mixed picture. In Papua New Guinea, you know, Papua New Guinea is in the Western Pacific region as defined by the World Health Organization. 65% of all the malaria is in Papua New Guinea, and almost 80% of the deaths are in Papua New Guinea in 2024. So that's, you know, in PNG, it was an overall 5% increase. So there it was a more of a difficult picture. In the Solomons, the report shows an increase of 70% or more. Now, when we talk about this, that kind of thing, you know, it could be that reporting has improved, but, you know, it's year on year when you start looking at it, Solomons has been increasing. And Vanuatu, though, I think is a bright spot where we've seen a reduction of 30% from between 23 and 24. So those are the sort of the three keys in when we talk about the Pacific region and malaria, and that's where we are.
As you said, Timor-Leste achieved malaria-free certification in July 2025. What led to this?
One of the critical pieces in the success of Timor-Leste, you know, as is true in so many countries, is really a leadership-level focus that was from the very top all the way down to how the program is delivered. So I think there are just a few things that I would call out that are important to note in what they've accomplished. This is a country which shares a border with Indonesia. And you know, I think the effort that was put into really strengthening surveillance in within the program itself was really, really important. And diagnosis and treatment being free for everybody certainly helped. And that was a decision made by the government. And then the standardization of using artemisinin-based combination therapy, which are ACTs, which is the most effective antimalarial medicine right now that that replaced older drugs. That was a key piece. Obviously, they worked to attack mosquitoes. So that was talking about treatment and testing. Then it's, you got to kill the mosquitoes. And they did that through their program, distributing insecticide-treated nets to everyone, not just vulnerable groups, and also making sure that in high-risk places, there was indoor residual spraying going on to kill the mosquitoes where they rest.
Based off the data from this latest World Malaria Report, what remains a concern, particularly in the Pacific region?
I mean, of course, the first thing would start with funding, right? There is a heavy reliance on the Global Fund, which provides resources for malaria, TB, and HIV around the world. And within our Pacific region, there is a heavy reliance on the Global Fund in these countries. So on the order of, you know, 40% or more, you know, that's something that is uncertain at the moment. To the second point that I want to make, which is about climate change, that's a huge threat too, right? Because climate change is happening. It is changing the way mosquitoes behave, where they breed, when they bite. And that means that we're kind of in a race against time to make sure that we can finish this malaria elimination job before climate change changes mosquito behavior and breeding behavior to the point where the things that we were doing before and where we were doing them doesn't work anymore. So that, I think, would be a second place that we need to be concerned. And then there's a third concern, which is that these things that we're doing, like let's say nets or let's say drugs, that they will be impacted by things like drug resistance, for example. So the drugs that we had before don't work as well anymore, and that is going to become a huge problem.
And that is Dr. Satik Das, CEO of Asia Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance, speaking there to ABC's Lucy Cooper. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Well, you can find our top stories when you search Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But you can find us on our socials on Facebook and Instagram by searching ABC Pacific. Our team will be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. As always, you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily with Chris Narita and Manu Leong. Until then, o toa o whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.